on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And I hope you're staying fit and healthy and well in these troubling times. Yes, we're going to be talking about coronavirus, amongst other things, but there's so much else that we need to be thinking about as well. And I know it's our main worry, particularly at the moment, but we also need to be thinking in general about other ways in which we can keep fit and healthy and other things as well, to help us just live more fulfilled lives. I think maybe this time at home, this enforced isolation, is maybe making us think perhaps a little bit about our lives, what we're doing with them even, and maybe reinforcing plans for the future and resetting goals for our future as well. So yeah, lots of things to think about really, isn't there, in these times. So, yes, I'll start off with the usual news roundup. So, thinking about other things that are in the news apart from coronavirus, that dreaded C word at the moment. Drugs causing falls and fractures in the elderly, apparently. Falls and fractures are common problems among the elderly, but apparently the real culprit isn't always old age, as we've been led to believe. It can also be the drugs that they're prescribed. Many of the drugs routinely given to the elderly, opioid painkillers, antidepressants, antacids and sleeping pills, either weaken the bones or increase the risk of a fall. And some even do both. And researchers from the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College analysed the records of around 2.5 million older people who had been prescribed any of the 21 most common fracture-associated drugs to see how many of them subsequently suffered a hip fracture. Now, the rate was highest amongst those who were taking the most FADs. The most commonly prescribed were opioid painkillers, which were taken by 55% of the people included in the study, followed by diuretics or blood thinners prescribed to 40% of them. Taking even one of these drugs doubles the risk of a fracture, the researchers estimate, and the risk increases exponentially for every other FAD being taken. Taking two FADs triples the risk, and taking three quadruples it. And the effects can be twice as bad in people who already have osteoporosis. The most dangerous combinations, the ones most likely to lead to a fall or fracture, were opioids and sedatives, opioids and diuretics, or opioids and PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, which are prescribed for indigestion. Now, if the drugs are optional, an elderly patient should seriously consider not taking them, the researchers say, and it's a consideration that's even more pressing if two or more FADs are being prescribed. And a little aside here about sleep. Apparently, supplementing with the amino acid tryptophan can improve sleep quality and the time it takes to fall asleep without impairing mental performance. So that's tryptophan. Can be good for you. And young women who take diet pills and laxatives to keep their weight down are much more likely to suffer an eating disorder just a year or so later. Laxatives increase the risk fivefold and diet pills by 80%. And researchers are now calling for restrictions on their availability, especially to minors. The pills are easy to get hold of, either as over-the-counter remedies in pharmacies or online. Instagram recently blocked minors from seeing advertisements for detox teas and diet pills. But researchers from Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, who described their findings as a wake-up call, want the ban to go further and to completely prohibit their sale to young people. In a study of more than 10,000 women aged between 14 and 36, the researchers discovered that 1.8% of those taking diet pills went on to suffer an eating disorder 1 to 3 years later, compared with 1% of women who didn't take the pills. The problem was even worse amongst those who took laxatives, including detox teas, with 4.2% going on to develop an eating disorder, compared to 0.8% of those who didn't take the drugs. As well as being a gateway to eating disorders, the products can also cause hypertension, high blood pressure, and liver and kidney damage too. So that's a bit worrying, isn't it? I think all of those pills, you know, perhaps not the right way forward, really. It's having a healthy diet, isn't it, that's the most important. And taking zinc on the first day of cold or flu symptoms reduces the average number of sick days. So that could be a useful fact, couldn't it, to bear in mind in these troubling times. Now, cancer patients live longer or can even reverse their condition if their vagus nerve is stimulated, which can be done through meditation, yoga and practicing compassion and gratitude, a new study has concluded. Survival times are 4 times greater in people with high vagus activity, and the cancer's progress is slowed, especially in the later stages of the disease. Now, the vagus nerve, which runs from the brain stem through the neck and thorax and ends in the abdomen, lowers our heart rate and controls food digestion, and it's involved in 3 major biological processes linked to cancer: oxidative stress or free radical production, inflammation and stress. Researchers at Fridge University in Brussels took another look at 12 studies involving about 1,800 cancer patients that have monitored heart rate variability, an indicator of vagus nerve activity. They discovered that the cancer's progress was slower in those whose vagus nerve activity was higher, and this was the case for all types of cancer. The effect of vagus activity was more noticeable in those whose cancers were more advanced or had spread to other organs. Now, the researchers say there are 4 proven ways to stimulate vagus nerve activity: exercise, meditation, yoga and compassion. And apparently studies by the University of North Carolina have showed that compassion activates the vagus nerve, and similar effects have been seen in those who practice the Buddhist loving kindness meditation. Very interesting. I mean, it was not so long ago that I was actually attending a workshop on the vagus nerve. And one of the important things that they were talking about was vagus nerve activity and various different movements and exercises to stimulate the vagus nerve, which some of you who may have been to my classes would have experienced recently. Very, very interesting. It just soothes the system. It soothes the whole body. And I know that everybody seemingly that's taken part in the classes has really benefited from this and feel very, very relaxed afterwards. So maybe worth asking your yoga teachers about that if you attend any or any other classes that you attend. Very interesting, very interesting. And the world's leading cardiologists have been told that the advice they've been handing out for 30 years about heart health could be wrong. Far from causing heart disease, saturated fats from cheese and red meat protect us from ever getting the condition and could cut the risk of an early death by as much as 25%. The amount we eat can be safely doubled from the levels that current dietary guidelines advise. So, for instance, we can have 4.5 ounces of red meat, which is equivalent to a small steak, every day, rather than the 2.5 ounces currently being recommended. Those who are eating more meat and dairy have a 25% lower risk of heart disease and a 22% reduced risk of a heart attack. Leading cardiologists have been told at the annual meeting of the European Society of Cardiology. Now, these findings show that the theory that saturated fats clog arteries and cause atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries could be wrong. On the contrary, saturated fats from meat and dairy seem to have a protective effect. So the best heart-healthy diet would include 3 servings a day of dairy products, such as cheese, and 1.5 of meat, plus 8 servings of fruit and vegetables, and 2.5 portions of nuts and beans. That sounds like a very good diet, actually, well-rounded. Apart from the meat, which I wouldn't have being vegetarian, but yeah, it sounds like a good plan. Analysing the results of a study involving more than 218,000 people, the team have concluded that the foods to avoid are refined carbohydrates. In a separate study also presented at various other research meetings, it was confirmed that people who regularly eat cheese had an 8% reduced risk of dying over the 6 years of the trial. So cheese isn't that bad for you after all. Say cheese could be the thing to do. Goodness, where is this all going? But anyway, saturated fats, not that bad for you after all. Now, obesity as well. Could a lack of sunlight be one cause of the obesity epidemic among children? It's certainly a possibility after vitamin D supplements helped a group of overweight and obese adolescents lose a substantial amount of weight after 1 year. Now, our bodies hold on to fat stores when we're deficient in vitamin D, which we mainly get from sunlight, especially during the summer months. Now, countering this deficiency seems to give the signal to the body to release stores of fat, as researchers in the University of Athens Medical School discovered when they gave supplements to a group of obese and overweight children and adolescents. Around half the children were given vitamin D supplements, which they took every day for a year, and the rest were instead given a placebo or a fake supplement. By the end of the year, the supplement group had lost significant amounts of body fat, their BMI, which is a marker of obesity, had dropped, and their cholesterol levels had also improved. Parents should ask to have the vitamin D levels of their overweight children checked, the researchers say. So that could be important. I just don't think we get enough sunlight at all these days, do we? Sitting in front of the TV and gaming, etc. More outside activity is what we all need. Right. Let's take a little break now. And after the break, yes, we're going to be talking about coronavirus and what to look out for, symptoms, etc. So stay tuned for more right after this.
Just
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And COVID-19, that is a word that's on everybody's lips at the moment, isn't it? And claiming more victims every day as well. And we're all on red alert, looking out for the symptoms that could mean that we are also infected. So the WHO, the World Health Organization, says the major warning signs are fever, fatigue and a dry cough. But other indicators include headache, shortness of breath, general aches and pains or a sore throat. And very few people, it adds on its website, will report diarrhea, nausea or a runny nose. However, as the virus affects more people, doctors are getting a clearer idea of other common symptoms, which may mean the WHO information is out of date. So although the WHO says a small minority of those infected with the coronavirus experience digestive symptoms such as diarrhea or loss of appetite, a study of 200 COVID-19 patients published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology found these symptoms affected almost half the patients early on in the illness. Now, the British Association of Otorhinolaryngology, which represents experts in ear, nose and throat medicine, said even a loss of smell or taste or the eye infection conjunctivitis could mean someone is infected. So I urged anyone with taste or smell problems to immediately self-isolate, even if they have no other symptoms. As with colds and flu, many of the symptoms those with COVID-19 experience are not actually triggered by the virus, but the body's attempts to get rid of it. Coughing, for example, is an automatic reaction we've developed to try to expel foreign organisms, whether they're viruses or specks of dust, from the airway. Nausea and diarrhea are believed to mark the digestive system's attempts to flush out the virus, and symptoms such as headaches and muscle pain are thought to be caused by the inflammation that arises in tissue as the immune system floods the body with defender cells to try to quell the invasion. But a sudden loss of taste or smell could be due to the virus destroying cells in the nose or even the brain. A study in the Journal of Medical Virology in February this year found coronaviruses such as this new strain may be able to infect the central nervous system, affecting some of the senses. But why do we all react so differently when our bodies are invaded by this virus? It's a fundamental question that's very hard to answer, according to experts at the Imperial College London. But it could be down to a combination of genetic differences between each one of us and the fact that our immune systems all have their own particular strengths and weaknesses. Now, our DNA controls the number and activity of the receptors we have on the surface of cells throughout our bodies, which act as a target for COVID-19. Receptors are like little locks that allow the virus to get into a healthy cell and infect it. It may be that those receptors are more prolific or more active on cells in different parts of the body in some people compared with others. This might explain why some people get headaches from the virus, but others develop nausea or muscle ache. But it may also be due to the fact that our immune systems are good at some things and not others. But the immune system is extremely complicated. It's a vast network of interconnected moving parts, and everyone has different areas where their immune system is really superb and other areas where it's quite deficient. So just how much the symptoms vary from one person to another are unclear at the moment. But we need to look out for various different things and what to watch for and what to expect if you become infected. So apparently, according to one person who lives in Norfolk, apparently she lost her sense of taste and smell, quite oddly, felt that she had a horrible taste in her mouth. And her partner had been ill the week before for about 4 days with aching limbs and fatigue. But as none of those matched with what she'd read about COVID-19, they didn't worry too much. And then she very quickly developed other symptoms, feeling sick and tired, but didn't have a temperature or a cough. So again, it wasn't on the radar. And within 2 days, apparently, she could barely stand and didn't have the energy to lift one foot in front of the other. And rather ominously at that point, she'd also started to cough. So she went to the GP to pick up some unrelated blood test results, and she took her temperature apparently and said it was high and that she should go to hospital. Obviously that was a bit scary. Turned out her temperature was about 39.9 degrees, and everyone had to wear a mask and she wasn't allowed to see anyone. The test results obviously confirmed that she had COVID-19. Apparently, she said she's never felt so ill. She's fit and healthy, no underlying illnesses. She walks miles every day and works out on a treadmill, but she actually felt awful. And the doctors kept her on paracetamol and fluids, and she needed oxygen tubes up her nose as her oxygen levels had dropped low. But the care was amazing. And poor nurse's hands were red raw, apparently, where she was washing so much. She couldn't face eating anything while she was in hospital and has apparently lost 10 pounds since her symptoms started, which is also quite worrying. And then after 5 nights in hospital, she was discharged and she was recovered, still weak, but still in isolation, separate bedrooms and bathrooms to her other half. And apparently no idea where she picked it up. Certainly hadn't been into contact with anyone who had been overseas. So, yeah, this is quite worrying, isn't it? It's the silent thing, isn't it? With anything else that you can see, you can say, all right, I'll avoid that. I'll look out for that. It's like stepping out into the road when a car's coming, isn't it? If you see one coming, you don't go into the road. But who knows what's in our oncoming path as we're walking about, which is why we need to be as careful as possible with all of this. Now there's varying different sorts of reports about how other people have experienced. I mean, another person says that they developed a dry cough and a high temperature, not worrying too much about it at first because they were mildly asthmatic, but then so short of breath, becoming so short of breath that the paramedics had to come out, and that because they were fairly sure that he had COVID-19, had to self-isolate. And another friend had gone out for a drink, developed symptoms. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Generally, it seems to start with feeling absolutely shattered, having an upset stomach and a runny nose, according to this particular person. So exhausted, feeling like they've been run over by a bus and brain not functioning right either, not being able to concentrate, aching all over, tight chest, loss of sense of smell and taste, loss of appetite, not eating for about 5 days in total, and also symptoms of diarrhea. On one occasion, apparently this person slept for 17 hours and took some night nurse, which is a sedating cold remedy. Self-isolated, just managed to survive on some supplies that he had indoors, and 6 days later finally noticed some improvement. And then poor soul's mother was taken ill and taken into hospital, and apparently it spread throughout the family. This is the thing, you don't really know who you're spreading it to, do you? Could be perfectly well, but the symptoms don't develop until about a week or 10 days later, do they? Another person's experience was no continuous cough, no burning fever, a slight tickle in the back of the throat coupled with a constant dull headache. And I've been with other people, nobody else was coughing and sneezing. And apparently one person had since been tested positive for COVID after having been at a meeting in London. But this poor lady's reaction was feeling exhausted, as though she was dragging herself through treacle and no choice but to go to bed. No cough, wasn't running a fever, but just a peculiar sensation of something settling deep within her lungs, almost like breathing in talcum powder, wanting to cough but not being able to. Even having a bath apparently made her breathe harder, and a sense that her blood pressure was spiking too. And when she looked in the mirror, her face and neck looked red and puffier than normal. Brain fog, unable to fill out forms from the children's schools, just wanting to sleep. And just had to basically keep away from everyone. And she self-isolated. And apparently this poor lady is mildly asthmatic, couldn't draw breath very well. And thankfully on the road to recovery now. Tightness in chest has reduced, but still having aching shoulders, pains in the knees, and worst cramps in the thighs and the calves, tummy pain, nausea. But, resting as much as possible and knowing that that she's on the road to recovery. And again, reports of feeling unusually tired, high temperature, taste and smell disappearing, no appetite, aching all over, pain in chest and upper back, despite feeling tired, finding it hard to sleep, dry cough, getting better for a few hours, then feeling worse, two steps forward, two steps back, etc. And and then just feeling that she had to self-isolate. Now, 10 days later, still feeling terrible, but still on the road to recovery. So, yeah, it's very, very difficult, very difficult indeed to know what the symptoms are. It's more than just a cold, isn't it? We're not just thinking about runny noses or anything like that. It's the whole thing, isn't it? It's really debilitating. So even if you're fit and healthy, it can attack you. So, okay, so that's some of the basic symptoms or the information of the basic symptoms that I can give you. So I think we're going to move on to something a bit more positive. We'll take a little break now and see how we can start dealing with some of these symptoms and getting ourselves back on the road to positivity and good health right after this.
You got too far this time, but I'm dancing on the Valentine. I tell you, somebody's fooling around with my chances on the danger line. I'll cross that bridge when I find it, another day to make my
Bye.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Let's move on to something a bit more positive now. In this current coronavirus situation, we're not really wired to tolerate uncertainty. So as the situation changes by the day, we're experiencing unprecedented levels of anxiety. Now, a 2016 study at University College London found that stress is maximised when uncertainty is at its highest. In fact, the study concluded that uncertainty is more stressful than knowing something bad will happen. So your body is likely now primed to do something to improve your odds of survival because your nervous system is constantly pumping out stress hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol, which will leave you feeling jittery and anxious. So what do we need to do in order to stop ourselves from feeling overwhelmed? So one way to exert some control over this situation is to establish a routine for your day. Set a time to get up, get showered, get dressed, have meals, and a time when you go to bed each night. This helps you to create some certainty in your day. And anxiety will be maintained by constant information checking and with news available 24 hours a day. It couldn't be easier, could it? So you might not be able to control the progression of a virus, but you can control how much you check the news. So just be aware of the number of times you do this. So give yourself a kind of a worry window to think through your concerns and write them down to get them out of your head. And closely following guidelines on hand washing and social distancing is not just good practice, but it can ease the stress too. In that same 2016 study on uncertainty, the researchers found participants who prepared for uncertainty performed best. So obeying the new rules can help you feel some sense of control and mitigate stress. Now, anxiety is worse when the brain has space to be scared. So try and fill your time and focus on tasks that bring you joy. For example, you could learn to take up a new hobby. Do anything you want to. Use this available time to do something that you've been delaying and always meaning to do. What's on your bucket list that you could do from home? You could learn how to play the piano, if you have a piano indoors, of course, or speak a foreign language. Creative pursuits all boost emotional health and can help you cope with self-isolation. Now, regular communication with friends, family, and neighbours via phone or video chats is very important to help maintain perspective, provide distraction, and lift mood. Humans are social creatures, so staying connected is important. Otherwise, being unable to socialise can become an additional stressor. Although face-to-face contact might be limited, help could take the form of giving to food banks, helping neighbours, or engaging in online community support. I think that a food bank point is a very good point, actually, because I think really the food banks are suffering at the moment. So if you're one of those people that's really massively stocked up and now finds that you don't need the food that you've got, try donating it to a food bank. It's a very good thing to do because there's a lot of people that are suffering out there, not just from the virus, but also from lack of access to food sources. The shelves are bare, aren't they? But it might sound obvious as well, but stress is exhausting and it depletes your body's reserves of nutrients needed to bolster your immunity. A disrupted sleep is a feature of stress and poor diet, and excess alcohol will only contribute to ever higher stress levels. Just get some good sleep. Go to bed at a set time, follow a calming evening routine, and avoid stressors such as mobile phones and the news at night. Exercise can counteract the chemical impact of a stress response. So all the evidence shows that 10-minute bursts of activity are sufficient to dissipate stress. So just do a little bit of exercise indoors, or if you can get out for a walk, that would be brilliant. Practicing gratitude during times of heightened fear and anxiety helps us to cope and lifts our moods, which work well in these troubling times. And it helps to maintain psychological well-being. So when you find a positive, take every opportunity to share it in any way that you can. And studies show simple breathing exercises can give you a powerful stress-busting tool in a crisis. When we're in fight or flight mode, the body draws in as much oxygen as possible to fuel the muscles. But you can calm this response very simply by ensuring that you exhale for longer than you inhale. So if you just breathe in, hold that breath just for a few seconds, then very slowly and gently exhale as if through a straw. And this triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, which causes your heart to slow and blood pressure to drop. And then cry if you want to as well. Sobbing, shouting, or expressing your anger and frustration by punching a pillow are all acceptable and perhaps even sensible forms of relief. So if tears build up, don't suppress the emotion. It's important to let yourself cry, but you might want to take yourself away and keep your outburst out of sight by anyone who might be distressed by it. So, I mean, that's a consideration for others who may be in your household. But, you know, we're all entitled to have all these emotions. We are living through worrying times. So don't be scared to kind of let the emotions out every now and then. But, yeah, maybe better if you do it in a private place. Go into the bathroom. Nobody will ever know what you're doing. And obviously schools, pools and gyms have shut because of social distancing. So there are other things that you can do to help yourself stay fit while being at home. No matter what your age or fitness level, resources are available online, from video classes to personal training via a conference call. There's, you know, plenty for children to do as well. Participation in sport, for instance, is really good. And there's plenty on offer to get the endorphins flowing as well. Those are the things inside your body that trigger positive feelings. And, you know, there's lots of different websites out there, you know, to develop children's skills, activities and videos, developing balancing skills, hand-eye coordination. And a lot of parents will be thinking about helping children develop their academic skills, but physical skills are just as, if not more important than fundamental for social development. It's important for children's development to make sure they're getting their hearts pumping and moving every single day. So there's lots of yoga type things, stories from yoga instructors, you know, with children as well, with positions to follow, yoga positions, and parents can do the workout sessions along with their children as well, so they both get the benefit. And I think Joe Wicks has put himself forward as the nation's PE teacher, broadcasting free half-hour lessons on YouTube each morning at 9 o'clock, which are aimed at children. He started his career offering online high-intensity workout sessions and last year toured primary schools teaching PE. And Joe Wicks live lessons are a good opportunity to get kids active before they start their academic learning. So for the more mature of us, the Green Goddess. Do you remember the Green Goddess? Gosh, that was years ago. Mr. Motivator. Oh, God, I hated Mr. Motivator. I found him very unmotivating, but back in the day. But now you can see the benefit, can't you? They've both been back on TV and radio as well. And I'm sure you can still catch up with them online. I mean, the Green Goddess recommends starting every day with a half-hour walk, while Mr. Motivator suggests setting an alarm at intervals in the day to remind you to move. And there is evidence that people who are fitter have better immunity. That's according to researchers at Loughborough University. For older people, it's essential to keep moving and maintain activity levels now, and it's a chance to learn to navigate online resources, perhaps with the help of a relative or over the phone. You know, don't overexert yourself if you're just starting out doing this. Go gradually, because the last thing you want at the moment is to injure yourself and have to go to hospital. But there's the Sport England website as well. And Sport England has put together lots of information to help people while they're self-isolating to incorporate regular movement. And there's information for all age groups and videos for less able people too. And for gym fanatics concerned the closures may throw them off the fitness wagon, this could actually be an exciting new frontier. In response to the crisis, several gyms have thrown open their doors online for the first time for free. And if you don't enjoy classes or find it too intense, as well, you can just kind of log out of it, unlike in real life where there's a lot more pressure because everyone around you is watching you. So it may even be something that that will be useful for the future, not just now. We're being very resourceful at the moment, aren't we, finding different ways to do things. The only downside of that is when you're following an exercise video, there's no one to correct you if you're doing things wrong. But there's plenty out there. There are certainly plenty of things out there for you to do. You just got to find something that works for you and build in time for your activity and just break the day up into chunks. And first thing in the morning, do you do some physical activity before breakfast? Just go out for a little run, come back, have breakfast, get showered and start work. Then do a chunk of work, and maybe at lunchtime there's another opportunity for activity, especially if you didn't do it first thing. It doesn't have to be long. Plenty of videos online are 10 or 15 minutes and easy to slot into a break. And even while you're working, just try to move. If you're taking phone calls, walk around. And that's easier to do in the kitchen than in the office, actually. So it may be beneficial, even. Right, so those are some hints and tips to relieve the boredom and just to try and keep yourself fit and healthy. Obviously, we've got quite a shortage of medicines available at the moment as well. So we're going to take a little break now. And after the break, I'll be back talking you through some hints and tips to just make you feel a little bit better. Unfortunately, no cures, but just things to ease the problem, especially if you haven't got access to medication. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, the coronavirus is well and truly with us now, isn't it? So, and unfortunately, the shelves are bare of things that we can use to help us, the medications. So if you're finding yourself stuck with no medication, don't know what to do with yourself, still feeling quite ill, I've got a few little ideas to hopefully relieve some of the pain and some of the pressure that you might be feeling. If you can't buy painkillers, for example, applying heat via a hot water bottle may give localized pain relief for muscular aches, and applying ice wrapped in a tea towel might help with pain from an acute injury such as a sprain. And to relieve sinus pain from a cold-like illness, paracetamol works best. So if you can't find this on your pharmacy shelf, ask your pharmacist because they may have an alternative. Now, pharmacists have been issued guidance from the General Pharmaceutical Council to use their discretion and split larger packs of paracetamol into smaller packs of 30, which will be made available to the public. There are also combination products that may be suitable depending on your symptoms, such as cold and flu remedies, Lemsips, for example, which contain paracetamol. Now, an authoritative Cochrane review in 2014 produced high quality evidence that adding caffeine to a standard dose of commonly used painkillers increases the pain relief for conditions such as headache and toothache. Caffeine is believed to improve pain relief by increasing absorption of the drug. So if you can't get your hands on painkillers, combined with caffeine, drink a cup of coffee with your usual painkiller. Could work. And a mug of coffee contains around 100 milligrams of caffeine and should have the same effect as some combination remedies. And it's cheaper too. Now, to soothe a cough, try honey. A cough is a symptom of respiratory illnesses, including the common cold and flu, as well as COVID-19. Now, most people who have this symptom won't get a confirmed diagnosis, as the current advice is to stay at home unless the symptoms become unbearable. Cough medicines are one of the over-the-counter remedies that are reported to be fast disappearing from pharmacy shelves. Most cough medicines combine ingredients such as decongestants and antihistamines and have been shown to be effective against coughs generally. Now, if cough medicines are unavailable, honey may be a good alternative. A 2018 Cochrane review looked at 6 trials and concluded there was evidence that honey may help children who have a cough, though honey is not recommended for children under 12 months. Honey is thought to have properties that work against bacteria, viruses and inflammation, and it's an ingredient in many cough syrups. It's also been suggested that due to its viscous nature, honey coats the throat and has a soothing effect. Certainly worked for me, I think, many times in the past. So, it's worth it, isn't it? Just to give it a go to see if it makes a difference. Now, earwax can get too hard to leave the ear canal naturally, and this can be caused by people putting cotton buds and earphones in their ears as well. Some people use liquid or spray products that contains safe forms of hydrogen peroxide, which softens and loosens earwax so it's expelled. Now, if these aren't available, then water or olive oil will work just as well. Just use a pipette to put a few drops in your ear while lying flat. Easy peasy. And just ease. I find it's good to give the ear a little massage as well. That really helps. And there's a lot of interest in vitamin C for boosting immune function, but evidence is mixed. A 2013 Cochrane review looking at vitamin C for the common cold found evidence that it may reduce the likelihood of getting a cold only for people who are doing short periods of extreme physical activity, such as marathon runners and skiers. More clarity is needed from better studies on the impact of vitamin C on the length and severity of colds. Nevertheless, supermarket shelves are being emptied of supposed immunity-boosting tablets such as Barocca, which contain vitamin C and B vitamins for energy. It may be a better idea to look instead for vitamin D supplements. There's reliable evidence from a 2017 review in the BMJ that vitamin D supplementation helps prevent respiratory tract infections, with the most benefit for people who have vitamin D deficiency. Now, how vitamin D helps is unclear, but one theory is that it induces the release of proteins by the immune system in response to bacterial and viral threats to help kill off the microbes. Your body can get vitamin D from exposure to sunshine, but the strength of the sun in the UK at this time of year is too weak to have this effect. Other sources include oily fish and shiitake mushrooms, but you'd have to eat large amounts though to get enough. So the evidence supports taking daily doses of 10 micrograms, which is good. And those are, or hopefully should be available still in stores and health food shops, or maybe even online if you look online. And sore throats are usually caused by viral or bacterial infections, and there are over-the-counter sprays and mouthwashes and lozenges that help ease the discomfort. They usually contain anaesthetics to numb the pain and antiseptics to clear the infection. And most sore throats get better on their own within 7 days. But if you feel like you need something to soothe the pain and these over-the-counter options aren't available, try gargling with a solution of salt water. Salt is nature's antiseptic. Put 2 teaspoons in a 400ml tumbler of water and gargle with it, but don't swallow. And the NHS also recommends sucking ice cubes or an ice lolly, as ice is thought to reduce inflammation and pain. Now, dry, itchy, allergic skin conditions are very common and cause misery if your usual moisturising or steroid cream is unavailable. What you can do is add oats to your bath. Oats, believe it or not, have an anti-inflammatory effect and will calm your skin down. They're also hydrating and will cleanse the skin. So if you put a mug full of oats in a muslin bag, tie it up and hang it in your bath water, brilliant. Or you could add a tablespoon of olive oil to your bath, which has a similar soothing and softening effect on the skin. See, we don't need all these fancy things, do we, that we fill our baths up with. We're good with all the kind of the average stuff that we don't even think of. I think those are two brilliant tips. And styes are small abscesses full of pus on the eyelid caused by an infection at the eyelash root. They usually heal on their own, but many people affected will buy creams that contain antibiotics such as chlorpheniramine. These work by killing bacteria that cause the infection. So if that isn't available, a warm compress can be made by soaking a clean cloth in hot water and holding it against the eye for around 10 minutes. That's thought to encourage the stye to release pus and to heal more quickly. Lovely. Easy to do. Migraine pain can be treated with over-the-counter painkillers such as aspirin, ibuprofen or paracetamol, but not codeine, which can cause rebound headaches. When these don't work, migraine drugs such as triptans can be taken 30 minutes later. And if your usual over-the-counter tablets are sold out, the best thing to do is confine yourself to a dark room and drink some hot milk, as it has a sedative effect. Applying aloe vera gel to the face and temples may also help. The theory is that the aloe vera scent has a muscle relaxant effect, which may ease tension that contributes to migraine. I think lavender may well work the same way as well. And if all your extra hand washing is making your skin dry and cracked and your supply of hand cream is running low, try eking out the last supplies by wearing cotton gloves overnight. If you apply a small amount of any moisturiser to your hands after washing them, wearing cotton gloves can keep the cream in contact with the skin and make your moisturiser last longer. You could also add a little coconut oil to make your moisturiser last longer. If you try it every night for a week, see how it goes. It's important you keep the skin barrier intact, because if it's open, you'll be more prone to infection. And laxatives are commonly bought over the counter to treat constipation, defined as having less than 3 bowel movements a week or having difficulty passing stools. Now, there are various types. Some have a stimulant effect and others bulk out or soften stools. Prune juice causes mild irritation to the gut and stimulates it to work. It contains sorbitol, a sugar that draws water into the gut, which has a natural laxative effect. Don't drink too much of it, though, or it could have a purging effect, and you wouldn't want that. You won't be able to get off the loo for days. And if you've suffered a minor burn from cooking, aloe vera may help. After first cooling the burn under cold running water, tear off an aloe vera leaf and squeeze the gel inside it onto the injury, and then cover it. Aloe vera is soothing, it has an anti-inflammatory effect and speeds up healing. A study of 27 patients by researchers in Bangkok revealed those treated with aloe vera gel healed faster than those who used a Vaseline gauze. And the average time of healing was 11.89 days, that's very precise, isn't it? Compared with 18.19 days for the Vaseline gauze treated wounds. I've also got another one for you as well, toothpaste. Now that sounds weird, doesn't it? But unfortunately, I've experienced a couple of burns myself recently. And toothpaste really does seem to do the trick. Just put a blob of toothpaste on your hand and just leave it there. If you want to, you can put a plaster over it or something with the toothpaste on top. For some reason or other, the toothpaste just seems to draw out the burn. There's no blistering and you're just left with a little bit of a red mark afterwards, which heals nicely. As we speak, I'm looking at the very burn that I used that on last, caused by the oven. And I have one on my fingertips as well, two fingertips got caught across the iron. I wasn't paying attention, was I? Very silly of me. But there we are, toothpaste worked. So I will leave you with those thoughts. So I hope you'll take something useful away with you from everything I've spoken about on the show this evening. And I know this, it won't be long before we're all back on the road to recovery again. Literally, the whole country, the whole world. So, there's anything that you can take from the show. Hopefully this evening I've helped ease your symptoms, ease your stress, ease your anxiety, maybe giving you some ideas of what to do at home in these troubling times as well to keep yourself fit and healthy. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.